August 21st, 1981. Maybe not an important date in your life, but in mine very much so. A memorable date. The day in which our firstborn came into the world. I became a father. It was a pretty emotional day for me. I know you think I'm not that emotional of a person. But in the birthing room of the Saginaw General Hospital in Michigan, a young man named Tim got pretty emotional. It was over 37 years ago. The emotions perhaps have changed a bit, but not diminished. Emotions of joy, of pride, love, I'll admit a little bit of fear, and just mostly feeling overwhelmed. It's not a small thing to bring a child into the world and then to think, look at that, I'm in charge of that life. I wonder, did the fear come from hearing this adage? Like father, like son? Very thankful to God for my father. I've only had one, so I can't compare him to others, but I have a pretty strong conviction that God gave to me a rather high-quality human father. And I tried hard, and still do, to live up to that, to be like Paul. So I think I found myself pondering as a 24-year-old, will I be up to the task? As Daniel watches my life and tries to emulate it, will that be a good thing? Will I live a life worthy of someone imitating? What's that going to look like? Being a father, in chapter 4 of Romans, is used in two ways. One, biologically, but more than that, Paul uses it as describing one who initiates. Someone who is the father of a thing, a movement, an idea. So if you're a football fan, you know that might know that Walter Camp is considered the father of American football. Did anybody know that? I certainly didn't, but thanks to Google, now I do. Gregor Mendel, does anybody know that name? Okay, a doctor raised his hand. He's the father of genetics. Jesus said that Satan is the father of lies. So this idea of father is used to describe someone who starts out a thing. It doesn't mean all-encompassing. It doesn't mean that Walter Camp invented everything that exists today about modern football. It doesn't mean that Gregor Mendel discovered everything about genetics that we now know. Certainly doesn't mean that Satan has told or invented every lie that's been told. Some you get credit for, you thought up yourselves. But it means somebody who started out the gate. Satan was the first one who told a lie. Abraham is considered the father of the Jewish nation. Remember, Paul's writing this letter to mostly Gentile Christians in the city of Rome who don't know a lot about Jewish history. Maybe they know that Jews revere Abraham as their father. I don't know how many of you grew up hearing or singing the little tune, Father Abraham had many sons. Anybody know that song? We don't sing it in church a lot. I kind of grew up thinking that he had really two sons. First, Ishmael, because he wasn't sure that God was going to keep the promise. And Sarah said, here, take the handmaiden to help God out. And then later, Isaac, the son of the promise. But in fact, after the death of Sarah, Abraham, we're not sure, maybe thinking, well, God said it would be like the sands of the seashore, and so far it's just two. So he took another wife, Keturah, and had six other sons in his old age. So I guess eight would qualify as many sons. So all Jews consider Abraham their father. Maybe you know that all Arabs consider Abraham, not consider, but he is their father through Ishmael. He's the father of what we consider Palestinians and Arabs in our world today. And Paul clearly considers this true for Christians as well, that Abraham is our father in the faith. And so he's introducing perhaps this idea a bit, reinforcing what the few Jews in that congregation knew already and teaching the Gentile or non-Jewish believers. Five times in this chapter, it starts off in chapter 1, Abraham is our forefather. Verse 11, he is the father of all who believe. Verse 16, Abraham is the father of us all. 17, he is our Father in the sight of God. Maybe you looked at the bulletin cover and said, why didn't Pastor Tim capitalize the F on Father for God? Well, he is our Father today, is speaking about Abraham, actually, and not God. And so I intentionally put a small F. And then again in verse 18, he became the father of many nations. Now in verse 1, the first one, forefather, and verse 18, the father of nations, is speaking biologically, that he gave birth to a son, as God promised, and that it became, as the sands of the seashore, a great nation. But the others, the father of those who believe, the father of us all, are speaking about Abraham being our father in the sense of an example, the one who began this idea of believing God in faith and walking with him. This is the topic of chapter 4. Abraham was justified. We talked about this word last week. It means having a clean slate. We talk so much in Christian circles about forgiveness. I sin, I ask forgiveness. I don't have to ask for the price to be paid. Christ already did it on the cross. But I appropriate that forgiveness into my life. But justified means not only I'm forgiven the penalty of that and I don't have to pay, it means that my record is wiped clean. So that if I would get arrested, let's just use an example, and at the police department someone opens up to see, hey, does this man have a criminal record? It'll say, ideal citizen, never did a thing wrong. Okay? Justified means living it just as if I had never sinned. And Paul says, Abraham was justified, he had a clean slate before God, by faith, not by works. Meaning, he didn't gain that, he didn't buy that from God, he didn't trade that with God by his obedience, but by believing. If you look back to Genesis 15, it tells a story of when God spoke to Abraham. He was 75 years old already, what we would consider a bit advanced in age. God gives me grace to live till 75. I'm sure I won't think it's old then. But as a 61-year-old, I'd say, it's a bit older. He said to him, Abraham, look at the stars. He didn't live in the suburbs as we do. There's no light pollution. He could see a dark night, the sky filled with stars. This is a picture, Abraham, of your offspring. Here's what it will look like. And Abraham, who's been married for decades and does not have a child, says, I'm taking you at your word, God. And Abraham believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. 3 weeks ago, we defined this word. Righteousness means to restore and meet the demands of the relationship. So God enters into covenant with Abraham, and Abraham's demand in the relationship is he has to live rightly because God is holy. He can't do that. He can't offer that. He credited it to him. Credit means you have a balance in your account. Most of us here have an account. We love to have credit, don't we? If I'd ask for a raise of hands, everybody'd love to have a little more credit than you do have in your account. I first learned about this, I think, in the first grade. In my grade school up in Brooklyn Center, I think monthly, the Farmers and Mechanics Bank, I've never understood why somebody would name a bank by that name, sent an envelope. It was a pretty heavy-duty envelope about this size with these two little buttons and a string to tie it. And on the first week of every month, we would bring money, and I had an account as a six-year-old in a bank downtown. And I'd put in a quarter, which is, I would probably put in $10 if I could, but I think that must be what my father gave me, a quarter. And so for 6 years of grade school, this happened on a monthly basis. And I went building up money. Well, I guess it didn't happen in the high school, so at the end of sixth grade, we got a check with our money that was on credit. And I was pretty disappointed to see it was like $21 or something. But it helped. I think the bank had a very wise idea. Teach children what it means to build something up. You have to deposit little by little. That's not the spiritual idea of little by little. It's God put a credit in there one time only, and it's good enough for eternity. This means God left the credit. He deposited it. So Paul says in verse 10, Under what circumstance was it credited? Was it after he was circumcised? That was the obedience to God's command. Or before? It was not after, but before. That is, God didn't give Abraham a credit because I told you to do something. Look at that, you did it. This is how we raise children a lot. Lots of teachers here, you do this in the classroom. How did Johnny get a gold star in his paper? He did what the teacher said. I know there's a whole thing about that today, and you can't let some students have more gold stars than the others, but that's how I was raised, and no one's here to comment on whether I got a bunch of gold stars or not, so I'm just going to leave it at that. But credit, not a reward for his works, but for his belief, came before his various acts of obedience to God. And why does God credit the righteousness to Abraham's account? Because he doesn't have any. He can't put anything in there. He has no holiness or right standing before God to offer. So here's a brief synopsis of the life of Abraham. Chapter 4 is a bit of teaching to the Gentiles in Rome, but kind of presumes that the reader is familiar with this biblical story from the book of Genesis. And you can look in Hebrews chapter 11 as well, that will outline these four stories, main things about him. God called him. Abraham wasn't raised in Palestine, or what we call, was later called Canaan, the promised land, or today we call Israel. Wasn't from there. He came way from the east in the Chaldeans in a land called Ur. And God called him to leave his home and his people and become the father of nations. He was 75 years old. We would think, you're going to start a nation or start anything, choose a young person, right? Some of you experience this in the workforce. Time to hire somebody? Out with the old, hire the kids getting in out of college, right? But God calls an older man. We think about the nation of Israel. You need a king to replace Saul instead of anointing a man, a king. God calls a young shepherd boy, David, who seems totally unprepared for that task. Second thing, God promised Abraham and his descendants the land of Canaan, far to the west. What would Abraham have known about Canaan? People didn't travel in those days like they do today, like we do today. And we would think, if you want to take over Canaan, call a local boy. Wouldn't that be easier? But he calls a man from far away. When he was 99 and Sarah age 90, God confirmed the promise of a son and the covenant of circumcision and that he would have a large family. And he changed his name from Abram. I keep saying Abraham, but until that point he was named Abram, and changed his name to Abraham. And this is a biblical model that's going to repeat itself over and over again as Old and New Testament people have their names changed by God to mean something new. Abram, interestingly enough, means exalted father, and Abraham means the father of many. So a man who was exalted but was not yet a father. A father in the sense of showing us the path of faith, but who would become literally the father of many. The fourth thing Paul actually doesn't mention here is that later God asked Abram to sacrifice his son Isaac, to bind him and lay him on an altar as if he would be burned as a ram in a sacrifice to God. Did not intend to harm the child, but was testing Abraham's faith. That could be confusing to us because what we're saying is, at the very beginning, before he left his home and started to journey to Canaan, he already showed God enough faith to credit him as a righteous man. And some 30 years later, God tests his what? He's checking to see if he has faith. So you can read in the Old Testament prophet these words, "So my thoughts are not your thoughts, says the Lord, and my ways are not your ways." Because we would think, if someone has proved themselves to have faith, Why am I testing it again? So was he the father of faith, the first one ever? It's about 2.5 years ago that we spent a couple of months preaching through Hebrews chapter 11, the heroes of the faith. Abraham was not the first on that list. Somebody want to, a student of the Bible, want to venture a guess? Who's the first hero of the faith listed in Hebrews 11? Starts with Abel. It's Abel, the son of Adam and Eve. Second one is Enoch. We don't know much about him. Noah came in third place, just a brief verse about each of them. And the fourth hero of the faith is Abram. He actually gets the most coverage. He dominates the chapter. Of all the heroes, Abraham gets the most coverage. But how then is he the one who initiates faith? Why was he the father if people of faith came first? Well, you know that because you have Hebrews 11. Would Abraham have known of any of those people? We can't understand how he possibly would have known. How would he have heard those stories? The books of the Pentateuch, the beginning of the Bible, had not been written down yet. So Paul the Apostle, if he were here this morning, would be saying to you and to me, Christians, Abraham's your father. Maybe you don't know that, but he serves as an example, and you should know his life and be motivated by it. Do you take pride in your earthly father or mother? The Bible says, this is one of the Ten Commandments, that you should honor your father and mother. Many of us do. Some of us honor in obedience, but don't take pride in everything that our father or mother was or is. And some of us do some of the time, but not all the time. How about a spiritual father or mother? Do you find joy in God's presence for someone who became an example to you in the spiritual life? You perhaps were not born into a Christian home, and that father or mother was someone else. Someone who led you to Christ, who helped you along the path to belief, who taught you, who corrected you, who served as an example, and maybe still does. So you might be thinking, Pastor, why is that important? And why do people in Rome, don't they need to believe in Jesus? Isn't that the whole thing? So the deal of Abraham thousands of years before, why is that so important? Why is Paul taking a whole chapter to talk about that? So just imagine with me for a moment the biblical account in this way. Let's say that it starts out in Genesis 1 like our Bible. God creates. He creates the ideal world. He creates in perfection. He creates people in his image. They sin and mess it up. God gives his promise to the human race that's messed up his ideal, gives his command, but no one gives heed. No one obeys. Romans 3:10 that we talked about last week, let's say that's the whole story of history. There's no one righteous, not even one. Nobody makes any attempt to acknowledge or obey God. God calls Abraham, but Abraham stays put, says, got a good life here in Ur, ain't going nowhere. Excuse my grammar. He calls Moses, but Moses says, no thanks. It's kind of a tough job to lead a million people. So God just talks to all the slaves in Egypt. I know if one didn't obey, these aren't going to happen in succession, but just listen for a minute. But only a few decide to leave Egypt, and they wind their way back to the promised land. And they begin to grow and become a people. God calls judges, but they refuse to judge. And they sell their judgment and decisions and give corrupt judgment. And God calls kings to rule over them, and they all decline. Nobody wants to be king. God calls prophets to speak his word, and they all refuse. Eventually, Jesus comes. And at adult age, he calls disciples to follow him. And they all say no. So he declares himself Messiah and says, I'll just do it on my own. And he starts to teach, and no one listens or cares, and he claims to be the Son of God. And in 2 weeks, they just kill him. He rises from the dead, but no one believes it. What if that story was the story of the Bible? First of all, you wouldn't have a book. You'd just have a pamphlet. See, we sometimes look at this revelation and think, this is the detailed story of God and theology. It's not. There's that in there. Most of this is the story of people who believed and followed. People like Abraham. Would you, okay, if this supposed nothing ever happened like it really did had taken place, this is the question for you. Would you be motivated to believe in Jesus then and to follow? I'm just saying this morning. Don't lose sight of what a vital element to our belief is the stories of heroes of the faith. Their lives, their example, their inspiration, their unwavering faith helps us believe that we can endure hardship, that we can tolerate pain and rejection and maybe persecution. And hold on to God when it seems dark. Isn't that what Paul means when he says, Abraham is your father in the faith? You're looking back and saying, how could someone, because this is what the world around us asks, as you know, who are the crazy people that think Jesus really rose from the dead and is building a mansion for you? Really? And he's going to forgive all the stuff you've done if you just say, forgive me. Like, who thinks this up? This is not just the truth. You can choose just to believe on the truth. God bless you if you chose that. But I think the answer is most of us believe inspired by fathers and mothers, our own or those of the faith. And again, what examples did Abraham have? He didn't know Abel and Enoch and Noah. So I'm thinking Paul's saying his faith gets a little higher mark than mine and yours. Because we can say, well, we're just imitating those whose stories we've read and heard and sung about and memorized. Luke chapter 1, this is one of those stories in my mind. The angel of the Lord appears to Zechariah, an aging priest, who had become the father of John the Baptist. And he said to him, Zechariah, do not be afraid, your prayer has been heard. With a comma, not don't be afraid, your prayer has been heard. Don't be afraid, comma, because your prayer has been heard. Why would an old and infertile couple still be praying for a child? I understand couples wanting to have a family. And this couple had prayed for a family. And whatever limitations they had in medicine 2,000 years ago, they kind of knew that already passed. Elizabeth is not going to get pregnant. They're praying just because they had strong faith? Is that the only answer? They were so extraordinary. Or is Elizabeth still praying because she knows the story of Sarah, the wife of Abram? Why would we not believe that? That their faith was motivated not just by the glory of God, but by the story of improbable people who believed God and he did what he said he would do. So I'm concluding with the two obvious questions that you're pretty sure I'm going to conclude with. Is this a goal in your life? Not just to be a disciple of Jesus, but to serve as an example for someone else. For someone to look at your life and say, I'm understanding God better by looking at Frank, by looking at Susie. They flesh this out for me. People don't have to have a Bible to understand the gospel if they know someone who knows and lives out the gospel. Your life does serve as an example to others. That's not an optional thing. It serves as a good example, or the other variety, that depends on how you live. So is that a goal in your life? To be a spiritual mother or father? For someone maybe to say when they get to the Father's presence in eternity, well, I didn't know much about Abraham, but I knew these people at Hope Church, and they lived out the gospel. And that was enough for me to understand. The apostles said to Jesus, this is in Luke 17, verse 5, Lord, increase our faith. These men had faith. They didn't move from Ur to Canaan like Abraham, but they left the tax collector's table. They left the fishing nets. They left whatever their life, these weren't teenagers, they were adult men who supported families, who had jobs and professions. And they walked away from it and showed they had faith. But they understood it wasn't that big and said to Jesus, increase our faith. Maybe you feel the need to pray that this morning. Lord, my faith needs to grow. So remove my fear and increase my boldness. And help me not just to say, well, on this day in 1993, I believed in Jesus. So God gave me credit in my credit account. I got faith. And whenever the world ends or I go on to glory before Jesus comes back, then I'm in. It's all good. But do I want to grow in faith? Do I want to look at heroes like Abraham and others listed in Hebrews 11 and say, my faith needs to be greater? You might say to me, I don't have that much faith to believe that my life could actually be a spiritual model for someone else. How much faith do you need for that? If you think somebody spilled pickle juice on your outline today, that's not what happened. There was actually purposefully glued on there a mustard seed. Jesus said, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, like, I don't know how you imagine your faith. I have faith the size of a semi-truck or a yacht or a candle or a can of Dr. Pepper. But you can't imagine anything too much smaller than a mustard seed. So if you've just got enough to get started and say with a clean conscience, I have a little bit of faith, you can be like Abraham, someone whose life others observe and serves as an example. I have a spiritual mother, Jeannie, have in the sense that she's my mother, not with us for many years already. And I learned from her graciousness and kindness and gentleness and hospitality and a very deep faith and generosity. Did I need that? Did you know all those things I listed? They're in the Bible. I could just read it and say, oh, you needed to be like that. Quite a bit easier, however, in that in my home I saw someone live that out. And I understood, yeah, people can live that way. You can obey the Lord and live in faith and glorify God and have your faith credited as good enough to be in the Father's presence. So if you're thinking, it's kind of a ho-hum thing, the spiritual walk, the Christian life. What do I really get for living like God wanted? Well, maybe you'll never understand in this life how your life served to exemplify the Christ life for others as Abraham's did. So here's a couple action steps for this week. Say thank you to a mother or father, to an example in your life. Write them a note. Send them a text. Some people don't know what sending a note really is, but call them on the phone. Express to them, this was impactful in my walk with God. And maybe you need to write down, here's what steps I need to take to become that person and keep passing it forward, as we like to say today, or paying back. We're not paying back God or other people. We're simply living in a way that pleases Him when we become a spiritual mother and father. And if you're not even in this spiritual conversation at all, then I offer you today as a benediction verses 7 and 8 of this chapter. We read them already. Blessed, happy are those whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the one whose sin the Lord will never count against them. If that's not a position that you live in today, then all the rest that I said is not that important. You need to start right there. We're going to pray right now, and if you are here today in that condition, are not a believer in Jesus, or a curious, or a wanderer, or not so sure, I'm just going to start with this prayer and ask you to repeat in your heart these phrases with me. Lord, against the voices of the world, I choose to believe. You really are the Son of God. You love me. You came and died for me. I say to you what you know, Lord. I am a sinner and ask forgiveness. And increase my faith. Help me to believe, to be sure that this isn't a dream, that it's not the craziness that the world tells me it is. It's really true. And I can live in the Father's house for all eternity.